youth is in a really good space right now. When I was young, nobody wanted to listen to me, but they really do have a seat on the table. They can have a seat on the table complaining about the issue, or they can have a seat on the table making real change.
It's all of our issue to solve. Let's use all the tools available to us to tell those stories, and we have to engage with the next generation today. We can't wait for 10 years, 15 years, not engage them and expect them to pick up where we left off. We need this seamless, energized transition.
The transition of clean energy will only be possible if we all work towards a common goal. The goal of ensuring everyone everywhere can live a dignified life on a healthy planet powered by sustainable energy. I'm Elizabeth Wangeshi Shege, an energy efficiency and cooling officer based in Kenya with Sustainable Energy for All.
And I'm Anant Vatwa, energy data officer working at SE for All. Here in Barbados.
Yay. Beautiful Barbados.
Beautiful Barbados. The sun is shining. The water is blue.
We are inside.
The beach is white and we are inside. This is our sixth edition of the Global Forum, the SE for All Global Forum. We are going to be bringing you all the discussions, all the debate, everything that's going to happen over the next couple of days. We're going to look at what the leaders are doing across the world, how they're working together to achieve the goal of sustainable energy for equity, security, prosperity. The question everybody's asking us is, why do we choose Barbados? There's nobody better suited to answer this question than our first guest. Let's hear it from her.
Energy is connected to two-thirds of 169 Sustainable Development Goals. Put very simply, you can't have the correct health system, you can't have the right gender balance, you can't have the right education system without energy. And working here with Barbados, who themselves have put themselves on the front line and said, look, we are going to also show as one of the nations that we want to achieve our net zero target 10 years before anybody else. This isn't because they do large emissions or anything. Their emissions are actually negative right now, but they want to show the rest of the world that they can do it right here. So I really want to emphasize that point because everyone's like, why Barbados? Why Barbados? Because the leadership and the people have put this in action and said, we are signing up to this ourselves. We want the innovation. We want to create jobs. We want to create prosperity for our people as an example for the rest of the world. So it is very, very important, especially as members of the press, that you understand this topic, understand that we're living in a world that is not equitable and it's not just. And what we want to create is make sure nobody is left behind, because as a lot of people have heard, and you should know, climate is not an issue for one country or another. You can't get to climate positive or net zero in one country and leave the half of the world behind. We have to do it together because we're all interconnected.
In case you're wondering who's on that clip, it's our first guest, and we are highly delighted to now be joined by Damilola Ongunbiyi, CEO of Sustainable Energy for All and UN Special Representative for Sustainable Energy and co-chair of UN Energy.
So, Damilola, welcome to Let's Talk About Energy. Tell us about this year's forum. What are we expecting? Obviously, we're going to cover everything at the podcast, but we want to listen it from you as the host or the co-host with the government of Barbados of this forum. What are we expecting?
So first, this forum is going to be super exciting. It's a way of bringing not just energy experts together, but experts in development and also climate. We have over 70 countries coming together and saying they want to, this is how they chart their way for their own energy transition. And as you know, that could be anything from getting to universal energy access or moving out of coal to a more sustainable option. So I love the fact that we are really infusing that intersection between climate development and energy, which is what we do. But we're also with the UN system saying, okay, we have to keep net zero alive. We have to keep the NDCs alive. And for our common good as a commonwealth, we need to come together and have these serious conversations of how we change these, how can I put it, commitments to actions. The other thing that's exciting is the youth, right? You know, the youth coming not just as spectators, but hearing from young people that this is what we've done since the last forum. This is how, you know, some learning you've done has influenced us. Some of the youth are now in government positions. I think that's really nice to see kind of it come full circle and us learning from them, because I think there's a lot of learning that come from the youth. And then finally, we're having in Barbados with a kind of superstar female leader that's showing that even in a small island development state, they can be the exemplar for the rest of the world on how to do things properly, how to do things inclusive, and how to really bring diversity. And then I know I said finally, but finally, it is all about equity, right? The energy transition is about equity, it's about security, it's about giving people dignified lives. And that's why we're all here. So next few days should be a lot of fun.
So we've heard a lot about what the targets are. But one thing we'd like to know, Damilola, about yourself, is what is your perspective on energy, especially growing up? What was your experience with electricity or fuels, clean cooking?
Well, I think my upbringings are slightly different. Even though I came from a developing country, I came from a very privileged life, which I didn't know was privileged at the time. So we never experienced things like electricity cuts or anything. I do remember at least grandparents still cooking with fuel wood. But I thought, oh, that's just because they wanted to. They enjoyed doing things like that. It was when I started getting a little bit older. I went to school in England. I came back and I started understanding the divide. You know, sometimes you can live in an environment, but because your whole ecosystem is set and you have staff and things, you think that's how it is. But then it gets to a point, and I think everyone needs to get to this point, to understand how privileged they are. And if we do not be unapologetic about helping the most vulnerable people, we can't be better people. So I think, you know, once I made that connection, I think I was about 24, 25, I was like, I want to go back to help people that look like me, you know, and give space to people that look like me to have a voice. And I think that's what I've always had moving forward. And you know, you guys know me very well. Any projects we do that we cannot implement, then I'm not doing it, because there's not enough time, and the people depend on us to be able to give them a better life. It shouldn't be seen as charity or aid. It should be seen as our responsibility. And you know, I think that's what the BT about Sustainable Energy for All and the staff there, they really care about the people. It's not a regular job, you know, it's not a 9-to-5. You have to look deep inside you, you know, and I think, you know, with the team that we have now, you will know if someone doesn't care and if they do care, right? And that's why it's the beauty of this team being so diverse, you know, and also coming from the places that are going through some of the hardest times, either for climate or development or financial unrest economically, it's important. And you know, that's why it was also important to bring the team here, right? To not just celebrate the technical people like yourselves, but also celebrate operations and comms and everybody that helps us create this entire ecosystem. I think our organization exemplifies what we're trying to see happen. And I guess lastly is that we don't want to be in a job in 5 years' time. If SE4ALL is still existing 5 years' time, we have also failed, right? So working with people who know that we're trying to get ourselves out of the job to create something amazing, and I guess it's that opportunity for other people is what I grew up with, is what I believe, and it's what really keeps me going.
I like that you've mentioned the 5 years as well. What would you say is the scale of the challenge?
I mean, the scale of the talent is stark. We have to electrify 157 million people every single year. And I don't have the figures to hand, but over 300 million people to clean cooking every single year. And not only does the financing doesn't match up, the projects don't match up to this as well. That's why we're spending a lot of time on the data side, on what really needs to happen, what policies need to be put in place, how much money is actually required, what are the DFIs going to bring, what the country internally generated needs to bring to the table as well, and understanding all the parts of the ecosystem and, you know, advising sovereigns, advising private sector on this is how you do it. And it's a lot easier when you're doing it from a space of data, right? But it's not easy, but we have to still believe that it can happen unless... I mean, that's the reason why we exist.
We have a lot of youth listeners for this podcast. Do you have any word of encouragement for the youth? I mean, I know you talked about coming the full circle. So any parting shot and the word of encouragement for the youth?
I mean, the youth is in a really good space right now. When I was young, nobody wanted to listen to me, but they really do have a seat on the table. They can have a seat on the table complaining about the issue, you know, or they can have a seat at the table making real change. And I always say that a stint in government or some type of policy making is very important. You know, just, you know, even if it's at the local government level, you need to understand the issues, right? Because government still plays a pivotal role in all our societies, right? So my push to the youth is really spend time understanding the issues, understanding the local issues, and try and find a way to, you know, to get involved in a true sense instead of only complaining about the problems, which is good. You still have to have your voice, but you need to get involved in providing the solutions.
Thank you very much, Damilola Ogunbi, for being our first guest on our Let's Talk About Energy podcast. We hope you have a very energizing few days at this forum, and I'm very sure we're going to catch you over the next few days. Thank you.
Now, to bring on our second guest, he's a very special one. When we talk about energy transition, emissions reduction is a crucial part of achieving all of our goals. There's one organization that's contributing to this thing in a really big way, and that is Formula E, the electric version of the famous Formula One.
Jeff Dodds is CEO of Formula E. We're so energized to have you join us now.
Pun intended.
Yeah, that's very. You've gone early with the
podcast. Oh, yes, definitely. We must do that. So, Jeff, welcome to Barbados.
Thank you.
And welcome to Let's Talk About Energy. Tell us about Formula E. In just 10 years, you've grown from zero funds to around 400 million.
That's right, yeah. That's right. So we're on our season 11, so our 11th season at Formula E. Obviously, 11 years ago, there were zero fans in Formula E because we didn't exist. Here we are 11 years later with around 400 million fans around the world and growing super quick. We grew our fan base, I think, by about 20-25% last year. So we're the fastest growing motorsport in the world.
And we've had Formula 1, Formula 2, Formula 3. Yeah. We've had them for decades.
Yep. 75 years for Formula 1 this year.
But what made you just, you know, move away from that and move to or get involved with a cleaner version of the sport?
So the actual original Formula E was founded by two people. It was founded by a gentleman called Jean Todt, who was the president of the FIA, and Alejandro Agag, who was a Spanish politician, businessman, entrepreneur. And they very much thought there was an opening in the market for a different type of motorsport. So a motorsport that was still single-seater, still looked amazing, but also embraced the principles of sustainability. And back then, there was only, I think, 300,000 electric vehicles sold in the world that year. But they thought this was technology that was going to grow. And not only was it going to grow, that a series like Formula E could accelerate the growth of it to take us away from internal combustion engines. So that was why it was developed. So developed as a racing series, but also with a very serious side to it, which was how do we support the energy transition and how do we create a new sport that's sustainable from day one? So under the old definition, you know, we've talked in this sport for many years about being net zero from day zero.
Going back to the same thing, we've had, you know, fossil fuels or ICs running the sport for, I don't know, 75 years, as you say. What is the impact that Formula E has made on clean energy? Like, what would you say, this is what we've done, not just for the sport itself, but, you know, focusing on a wider, cleaner energy? Yes.
So you're right. So let's set the context, right? So internal combustion engine has been around for about 130 years. I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but I think it's 1896, something like that. So it's been around for a very, very long time.
Sure.
Formula One, 75 years. So for roughly half of its existence, internal combustion engines, there has been a racing series that uses that technology. If you think about battery electric vehicle technology, only really been around as a mass market concept for about 30 years. I think 2008 was the Tesla Roadster, which probably was considered to be the first mainstream electric vehicle on the road vehicle. So the technology is under transition. And, you know, we've gone from 300,000 electric vehicles sold per year back then to now probably between 17 and 20 million electric vehicles sold in the last 12 months. So this technology is growing incredibly rapidly. And if we look at the trends and the forecasts over the coming years, we will begin to see this become the preeminent technology. And of course, most governments around the world now have said, you know, beyond 2030 or 2035 or 2040, depending on which government you're talking to, you won't be able to drive a car that isn't new technology or largely battery electric vehicle. So the technology is there. But the great thing about this technology is it's not only better for the planet, it creates higher performance cars. So in time. So we're very in the infancy of the technology, and already our cars have gone from, in season one, they weren't very good. They did, I think, about 140 miles an hour, or they were capable of doing 140 miles an hour. The energy in the battery lasted for half a race. So drivers had to hop out of the car halfway through, jump into the next car, and that would go. And they accelerated to 60 miles an hour, 100 kilometers an hour in about 3 seconds. So here we are on our 11th season. The cars accelerate in 1.8 seconds to 100 kilometres, 60 miles an hour. That makes them roughly 30% faster than the Formula One car. You only need one car now. There's no hopping between the two cars, and that car will race for 45, 50 minutes to an hour, roughly, on one charge. We have technology that fast charges the cars during the race, like a pit stop. It can put 10% of the battery life back in simply in 30 seconds, which is absolutely incredible. And these cars are capable of 200 miles an hour. So you look at how far that technology has come in a short period. And to your point, we're not developing just things for racing cars. The technology that's developed on the track finds its way back to road cars. So it's this very circular approach. So we talk about our track being a laboratory for Porsche, Nissan, Stellantis, Jaguar, Mahindra, all of these big companies, Yamaha, Lola, to test technology on the track, to learn from the track, and then to use that back into their road car development.
One of the things we hear a lot from, you know, governments on the basis of transition, especially e-mobility, is quite a lot of different kinds of challenges. So looking at even this forum and the logistics for actually getting this forum going in Barbados, there were some challenges as well. What are the challenges that you actually face in the motorsport, electric motorsport series as well?
Well, so one challenge is as we grow this series, a lot of the fan base of motorsport have grown up with motorsport. So they love the sound, the roar of the V10 and the V8 engines, and they love the smell of that and the rumbling and the visceral nature of it. If you come and watch our sport, of course, you don't get that so much. They sound more like fighter jets or more like a spaceship from Kylo Ren's spaceship from Star Wars than they do a traditional V10 or V8 engine.
Right.
So part of that is about conditioning existing fans that there's a different way. And by the way, if we want to get slightly techie, I know we don't want to...
No, please go ahead.
So if you think about a combustion engine, a combustion engine is around 50% efficient.
Yep.
And I'm generalising here between road cars and Formula One cars or whatever, but generally 50% efficient. That means half of the energy created through the process of combustion is lost into the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And what you hear when you hear that rumbling roar is the sound of inefficiency.
Oh, yeah.
So a Formula E car will be in excess of 90% efficient. So for me to, because I get asked the question quite often, well, couldn't you make them sound like old cars? Because then you might attract some existing fans. So I have this kind of allergic reaction to making the future sound like the past. For me, that makes absolutely no sense. And, you know, our kids and next generation will grow up driving electric vehicles and it will bear no resemblance to that noise. So for me, we should embrace the sound of efficiency. But the other thing we have to do is not just fish in the pool for fans of existing motorsport fans. Because if we only do that, it's a very limited pool. We have to bring new fans to the sport. This is the next generation of fan to the sport. So Formula E is a young business. We attract a younger audience. Our audience is roughly 50-50 male-female split, very unusual for motorsport. And we're always looking to how we can bring new fans to the sport. We've just done an event in Miami called the Evo Sessions. 11 of the world's most followed content creators in the cars, talking to their audience, largely a younger audience, in their own voice and telling the story of Formula E in a way that their fan base will relate, which hopefully converts to new fans in the sport.
Great.
I think not everybody can, have a race car, so to say, or
definitely
electric race car.
Yeah.
What do you think is the future of mobility or electric mobility, for the non-racers?
Well, so I think you only have to look at the present to get a sense of the future because the development in that space is happening so rapidly. So you already have new cars launched now with ranges of well in excess of 500 miles. So we're seeing the range expansion on the vehicle, the efficiency of the vehicle go up incredibly quickly. So for those people that have range anxiety, which is, my elderly parents live 150 or 200 miles away, I can't have a car because I can't get to them and back on one charge if I don't do it. That's disappearing quite quickly. I think people historically have been worried about the performance nature of the car. So will it look okay? Will it go quite quick if I need it to? Or is it going to be like an old golf buggy or a milk float or something like that? Well, that's gone away. So I think they see today cars being launched that look cool, that are highly performant and have this great range. So look, my ambition is that over the coming years, providing the countries and the governments you just mentioned can continue to build out the infrastructure that's required to help the transition, I think there's an incredibly rosy future for electric vehicles. As always, there are barriers and blockers and bumps in that road because not everybody is as incentivized to help that transition happen quickly. But for me, it's an inevitability. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and we watch that space.
So you being here at this Sustainable Energy for All Forum in Barbados, what would you like to take away from it?
Wow, that's a big question. So first of all, there's nobody here that professes to know the answer to everything. So we're all here to learn and to listen to different perspectives from different people, from different countries with a different opinion and a different context to ourselves. I was asked just last week by somebody, what does high-performing teams mean to me? And I reflected on that. And I think the answer I gave was that that's about really impressive individuals who, when they come together, make better decisions and execute them more effectively faster. So I'm excited to be part of this team of people that are here. We're all like-minded. We're all focused on the future. We're focused on energy transition, on renewable, sustainable energy. So I hope to go away from here understanding the topic, not just better, but from different perspectives, hopefully adding something to that debate and that discussion. But as a result of this coming together, we make better decisions and we make change faster together.
I think now coming back to racing in itself, if energy transition is a race, what lap are we on?
Whoa, that's a big question. That's a really good question. So, well, we're definitely not on the opening lap. We're definitely not on the warm-up laps. Yes, yeah. Or the formation laps. In a typical Formula E race, maybe there's 30 to 40 laps. Let's say 40 laps. We have a long way to go, but I would say we're making good progress. So maybe we're through the start of the race and already the leaders have started to establish themselves, but there's a plenty of opportunity left in the race for people to come through. So I would say maybe we're on about lap 10 or 15 of a 40 lap race.
That's good. That's good.
But plenty of headway to go. Yeah.
That's true. Do you have DRS or equivalent in e-sport?
Well, so DRS, drag reduction system. So DRS is a very particular type. The DRS exists in Formula One effectively to allow people, once they get close enough to the car in front, you know,
just go.
So they get to that. They then are able to change the dynamic of the aerodynamic principles of the car, which allows them to overtake. We have something similar, but not the same. Because we're an energy-focused motorsport, ours is different. So there is a section on the track, which you will see digitally on screen, but the teams and the drivers know exactly where it is. If you pass through that section, it's called attack mode. And if you pass through that section, it does two things, and it does it over the air. It basically unlocks an extra 50 kilowatts of power in the car, and it unlocks all-wheel drive. And those two things together give you the same effect, which is the effect that you're able to go into an attack and hunt down and overtake other cars. Of course, it only happens for a period of time. So we have about 8 minutes per race, and it can be broken down in 4-4, 6-2, 2-6. But the team will choose strategically when to take it and how much time to take. And for that period, you can either use it to attack and overtake people or perhaps to defend your position. So yes, we have a similar concept, but delivered in a different way.
That's new knowledge for me.
There we go, Anna. I like to help.
We're here to learn.
Educate. Exactly.
So in space of energy transition, what is the attack mode that we can use? You know, you said we are on lap 10.
Yeah.
So what is the attack mode for us and how can we use it?
So look, I think for me, we're here together as a combination of public and private sector coming together. So that's the first thing. So for me, one of the attack modes is this is not a government problem to solve, and it can't be solved by the private sector. It has to be solved in collaboration between the two. So that's one element of attack mode, I think, for the energy sector, energy transition. I think the second thing is using all the tools available to us. So, for example, sport, and I mentioned this earlier when I was chatting, sport is nothing unlocks passion in people and interest and excitement like sport, but we tell the stories of sport. We don't always interweave into that the more serious stories to help educate the people watching the programs. So using all the tools available to us will be the next thing. And we can't forget, generationally, you know, this is our remit today. It becomes the next generation's remit tomorrow. So finding ways to engage the next generation around this topic for me is also incredibly important. So I would kind of put those three things together and say it's not a single issue to be solved by private or public. It's all of our issue to solve. Let's use all the tools available to us to tell those stories. And we have to engage with the next generation today. We can't wait for 10 years, 15 years, not engage them and expect them to pick up where we left off. We need this seamless, energized transition.
You definitely have loads of fans from this conversation. Including well,
there's only
myself.
Two of you. I'm not sure you can say no. Listening. He was already a fan as well. That doesn't count.
Well,
I've got one
be
new
others.
Fan, but I'm taking it.
Fantastic. So thank you very much
no,
for your
my
time.
No, my pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
Excited to have you at the forum and wishing you energized next
thank
couple
you
so
of
days.
Much, yeah. Good luck. Enjoy the next couple of days.
Thank you, Jeff, for this wonderful conversation with us. And for our third and final guest, we have got Emmanuel from CLASP. CLASP is an organization that we worked closely with. I'm a big fan of their work, and they are dedicated to energy efficiency in all of the appliances. So you have fridges, washing machines, electric motors, etc., both in on-grid and off-grid.
Welcome, Emmanuel, to the Let's Talk About Energy podcast.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So I'd like to hear a little bit about your perspective on energy, especially maybe electricity when you were growing up, maybe clean cooking as well. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
Thank you very much. So I grew up in rural Ghana, and I remember very well my father was in the army. And once he retired and we moved back to the village, he brought this TV set from the city, and we carried it to the village. But there was no electricity to power all this TV set. And what did he have to do? He bought a car battery. And that car battery is charged periodically in the nearest town, which then powers the TV set. And I had this image about moving from in the city where we had access to electricity, powering all appliances, and then moving to the village at a very young age, around 8, 9, and having to be sleeping in darkness. And the only way to get news is to now look at forward to this TV set being powered by a car battery. And those really way back in the 90s in Ghana, and you had a lot of communities which were contributing money to top up what government rural electrification was doing. And a lot of these communities really had to wait for many, many years to get connected to electricity. And that really sparked something in me. And since then, after having started my career, I think, and pivoting to the energy access place, I found a very beautiful soft spot, really working in something that really endears to my growing up and having experienced this problem from start from a very young age. Yeah.
That gives the motivation of, you know, why you're doing what you're doing, how you're doing it.
I'm so happy in this sector.
it's a good thing to be happy.
Most definitely.
I mean, welcome to Barbados. You know, you're here at the SE for All Forum. I think you've been to previous forums, so you know what to expect, what's going to happen. I want to know, what are you looking forward to? Is there any specific outcome? You have some sessions which you're like, I'm just going to be there. So anything that you want to share with us?
So thank you very much. Last week, I was in London for another energy-related forum. And during one of the dinner event, a few friends got us. We got together, and one of the things that was really on top of our mind is how complex is energy access and efficiency in Africa or in developing economies, that for all these years, this problem has never been solved or the needle has not shifted for all these years. And it was a topic that really got us all thinking and talking the whole night. But we resolved that, look, despite all the gloomy nature of the whole challenge, the whole success, we need to celebrate little progress, little success as it's happening. For this particular forum, I am here with the same level of intrigue to really, first of all, quantify the progress that has been happening and celebrate the little success that has been happening. But most importantly, we also value the new momentum, especially around M300. That at least for once in our generation, in our lifetime, we see a big move which seeks to tackle this issue at least once and for all, at least create a certain pathway that we see policymakers, funders rallying around this specific issue to really resolve it. So I look forward to all those conversations and love to see where the financing go, especially during this meeting this week. And see especially where the private sector comes to play, where we can deploy public financing to tackle this issue, at least in our generation. We want to see some real progress in our generation. We don't want to leave this problem for our children. Yeah,
true. I think that's a really good way of, let's leave a better place than we found it. Yes. So.
Definitely. And we only have 5 years to 2030. Yes. So what are the most exciting innovations that you've seen in energy efficiency as well that you could share with us today?
So at CLASS, we are very heavy on appliance and its efficiency because we see appliances as a very important segue for benefits for people and the planet. We work a lot on with manufacturers, with innovators in trying to improve the energy performance and also the environmental performance of appliances. Over time, we've seen a lot of innovations, a lot of work being done in the clean cooking side. There's a lot of constant innovation from the moving at least clean cook stoves now to more become more efficient. We see a lot of work being done in e-cookers, induction cookstoves, and all of that. And through our Global Leap program, we support a lot of innovation competitions for manufacturers to come up with new iterations, better, let's say, technologies in that particular area. So that is really one thing that at least we are very passionate about. Of course, we work in with other appliances such as fans, such as solar water pumps. We have published, I think last year, a Net Zero Heroes report. In this report, we outline the top 10 appliances that are very critical for moving the climate emissions reductions and also that benefit people. So these are from a range of cooling appliances, refrigerators, solar fans. And then you also look at agricultural productivity, solar water pumps. And of course, you look at the household productivity appliances like clean cook stoves, e-cookers, and all of that. And that's a lot of things that we deploy innovations around funding through the Global Leap and also financing. So financing needs to go to where it tackles the problem the most. And we see finances to early stage companies, local distributors in various countries that are really cracking the markets in their various countries, last mile distributions. So we deploy a lot of early stage financing for distribution, but also through the Global Leap competitions to manufacturers to what? To improve upon the technologies.
So basically tackling the problem from the ground up.
You know? Yes.
Oh, that's great.
Yep.
We talk about Africa not having access. So that's the issue that's been constant for the last, I think at least last 7 years. Where do you see Africa going, moving in terms of energy efficient devices or, you know, just access to electricity over the next, you know, when we talk about SDG 7, we need to be there by 2030. Let's hope that we are there by 2030. So where do you see, or what role do you see Africa or African youth? You know, we're talking about solving this problem in this generation. Where do you see, or what do you see the role of the youth in the country or on the continent?
So the youth are definitely the most productive factor or workforce in all this movement. And I'm very glad that in this conversation, we have a lot of young people, especially at this forum, who are actively, not only from civil society, but these are people who are actually solving a lot of problems from manufacturers, from funders that are really involved in this, trying to find a solution to this very huge problem. You mentioned something on efficiency. Efficiency needs to go hand in hand with the conversation around the supply side assets. So the more efficient you become, the less appliances consume energy, and that creates a lot of buffer for redistribution to other productive sectors of the economy. And African policymakers have always been at the forefront of the energy efficiency policymaking issues. In Africa, we may call it a different name, like dumping, anti-dumping, and all of that, but they've always been at the forefront, especially from changing from fluorescent lamps to now efficient LEDs, and that work has really been very phenomenal in a lot of other countries. You're looking at refrigerators that have been banned, old refrigerators that have been banned in other countries and all of that. So we need a lot of young people to get into the policy-making process. This is something that should not be left for, let's say, quote unquote, the older generation.
Yes.
We need to take a very strong position during the policy-making process. A lot of young people, innovators, are involved in the business side, but policy and the business operations go hand in hand. And that's what we see a lot of. I want to see a lot of young policymakers in ministries, in agencies, in departments, in African countries. And also on the awareness-raising part, when we go to our communities, I think let's carry this message from these high tables to our various communities. When I go back to Ghana, I think it is very important, it will be very important for my community to feel all this volume of knowledge that we have acquired over these past years in our various communities. Let's create awareness around these particular issues and let's drive change from at least the communal level, ground up, and then at least it can fit into some level of decentralized policy-making process, and then that can get carried upwards.
I think that's a great message to our young listeners.
True. Actually, get into policy.
Yes.
Get into policy.
Yes. To everyone, really. Yeah. Even the policymakers allowing the youth to actually get on the table.
Yes. Yeah. It's all about getting the seat at the table. So, which yes. I think they are yeah. right now. Yeah. It still needs to grow more, but we're getting there.
Yeah.
Glass half full. Let's see it that way.
Well, I think with this conversation, what would be your parting shot to the different listeners that we have? We have a lot of young listeners globally, beyond Africa. We have listeners also, you know, across policymaking, you know, there's climate conversations as well. They're listening to us. What would be your parting shot from what we've discussed so far?
Look, let's not leave this problem for our children. This problem of energy access, energy efficiency, let's not leave it for our children. I'll be very worried if my kids ask me one day, Dad, what have you been doing for all these years that you're working in this sector?
Sure, sure.
That we are back here to do the same thing. I worry about that. And I think that's my parting.
Thank you very much. Yeah. That has been a very energizing conversation. Yeah. And thanks for being one of our guests at this Let's Talk About Energy podcast. Hope you enjoy the next few days. And we hope to see you on the streets of the forum.
Thank you very much. And it's a fantastic week. And let's all enjoy it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Fantastic day we had with all those conversations. What do you think, Anand?
It was a great day. We had amazing speakers. We had some fun talking to them. And I hope the listeners had fun listening to them. It's still sunny outside. We are done for the day, but we can still go out.
Yes, we must run to the beach.
Yep.
But tell us, where are we going to be tomorrow?
We are going to be at the Lord Erskine Sandiford Center here in sunny Barbados. The program starts at 9:30 in the morning. We'll be back with all the action that we're going to get at the forum. We've got high-level dignitaries. We've got amazing speakers. And you've got us. That'll be great. I was just outside. I saw the delegates already coming in, showing up at the hotel,
fantastic,
getting their badges. They are energized. We are energized. It's going to be fun.
I'm really looking forward to it. So please join us for the next episode of Let's Talk About Energy. And please follow us wherever you get podcasts. See you next time.